But if you're inclined to grow benign things, you're more inclined to grow malignant things, and they should be watched. Women who have had a long reproductive life, and this is where estrogens come into it, if you've started to menstruate early and have a late menopause, then you've had that many more years for estrogens to go wandering around in your bloodstream. And your risks are higher. Mm-hmm. The later you begin to menstruate and the earlier you have your menopause, the lower your risks. The age at which you've had your first child is important. If you had your first child before you were 20, your risks drop way low. And if you have your first child after age 35 or no children at all, your risks are high. And nobody really understands that at all. The only hypothesis I heard is that there's some kind of an estrogen time clock that gets triggered. But this is true around the world. The only difference are the ages. Mm-hmm. In Finland, for example, the age is 26 because they tend to marry later. The age of menstruation here, the average age is 12. So when you say early menstruation, it's before 12. But in Finland, the average age is 16. So it's before 16. So yeah. It's only the biological clock chronologically that changes. But the factors are the same. Breastfeeding is something that is being debated in this country. The general opinion seems to be it doesn't make any difference one way or another. But in Europe, I found absolutely a universal consensus that breastfeeding confers protection. Mm-hmm. And the reason that this may be so is that they do breastfeed their children a lot longer in Europe than they do here. And theoretically, according to the laboratory knowledge, you are protected while you are breastfeeding. So if you have five or six kids and you breastfeed each one for 3 years, you are protected for 15 to 18 years, whereas here, what do we breastfeed them? 3 months, 4 months, that's a lot. Mm. So you really don't have that much protection. It's not the breastfeeding in itself. It's the period, the length of time while you are breastfeeding. But I've got that in a debatable area because it is debatable. There's just been a difference of opinion. Diet, now, this is where lifestyle enters into it. If you look at the official statements in scientific journals, they will talk about affluence and education. But you have to break that down and see, well, why does affluence help? Well, if you're well off, the chances are that you will go to college, mm-hmm. which means you will defer the age of your first child. Mm-hmm. The chances are you will take the pill, mm-hmm. which has not been proven to cause breast cancer in humans, but it has been proven to cause cancer in lower animals, mm-hmm. and certainly has been proven to feed a cancer in humans. And you're less likely to breastfeed. You're more likely to eat a lot of meat, and you're more likely to use butter instead of margarine. And there are all kinds of differences in your lifestyle that education and affluence make. You've got double incomes. If you're educated, you'll usually use it, which means you've got a greater income and you can do even more meat eating and so on. And it has been shown that, again and again, that in populations that are better nourished, the girls start to menstruate earlier. And a woman's menstrual cycle and her whole menstrual history is a very good barometer of her general health condition. Mm-hmm. And so they all sort of, it's a detective kind of jigsaw puzzle where the pieces fit in with each other. But the incidence around the world is very high in countries where meat is plentiful, where people eat a lot of meat, a lot of animal fats, cheeses, butters, and so on. It's very low in Japan, where they don't...
They eat a lot of fish.
They eat a lot of fish. And the average Japanese eats something like 6 pounds of meat a year, and we eat about 350.
Yeah.
And Scotland is very high, the Netherlands is high, parts of Canada are very high, New Zealand, Australia high. And you get a country like Germany or France, the northern part is high, the southern Mediterranean area is low. They eat olive oil.
Instead of butter. Yeah.
And of course it doesn't help to have diethylstilbestrol fed to our beef.
No.
I hope that people write into their congressman. It was banned in the Senate, but it hasn't come up for a vote in the House yet, and that really has got to be banned, but it's an election year. There are a lot of farmers out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
It does save a lot of money on feed.
Wonderful.
And the pill should have a label on it, by the way. The oral contraceptive is supposed to carry a label saying that women who have had breast cancer themselves or have it in the family should not take the pill. Somehow it is not on the label. I don't know why.
It's just the only thing, when I read the chart, I immediately went for my pencil and started ticking off where I fit, and I found to my horror that I fit in the highest, I mean, I have like a half a dozen different categories in the high risk level.
Well, women who, you're still too young to have to really go in for annual mammograms.
30?
Yeah, you don't need it annually.
No?
No. No, I don't think any woman under 35, unless she has a symptom, if you get a lump, yeah. But if you don't have a symptom, you don't need a mammogram. But find yourself a good breast doctor. Somehow.
Yeah.
And examine yourself every month, and any deviation from the norm, any discharge, any change of skin, any change of shape, any sign that one breast is doing something the other breast isn't, when you're doing the same thing with your arms, take it in, and certainly any lump or thickening.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not the only symptoms. And when you examine yourself, grease up your hands with either soap or oil. And I see the chart. If I had it to write now, I would put in a paragraph about thinking of a balance scale, an analytic balance. And for everything that makes you high, you put on one side, and everything that makes you low, you put on the other side, and if it's intermediate, leave nothing, and then see which side tips. Women over 40 should have a mammogram once a year. Now, there's been a lot of arguments about the fact that mammograms can give you cancer. Well, this is nonsense if you have it done by good machinery. Now, I have recommended whenever any women ask me, they go to a hospital or a very busy radiology clinic like the Guttman Institute here in New York, because they have a big enough turnover that they have the best equipment, they have it inspected. I don't know what your inspection law is here, but a lot of states have none. And they have all the attachments so that, you know, you get the maximum illustration of the breast without too much radiation. And exposure should not give you any more than 2 rads per breast. Now, all I can say is that if you have a mammogram once a year, let's say they need 2 exposures of each breast, that's 8 rads, which means in 10 years it's 80 rads. 20 years, 160 rads, okay? The average dose of therapeutic x-ray that they give for breast cancer, wrongly or rightly, is 4,500 rads. 4,500 rads.
Yeah.
Now, when you've got to measure the positive, I mean, everything in life is a trade-off. This is particularly true in cancer.
That's the
if
point
you
I wanted
are
to get
going to
to
sit there and worry about getting 4 rads a year.
Right.
And trade that off against the fact that something might be growing in you, then you've just got to make that decision. Do the benefits outweigh the risk? I have a mammogram every 9 months of my remaining breast if I have no symptom. If I feel something that might be a lump and he agrees that it's worth, you know, looking at it, then I have it more frequently. And I am the highest risk. And I'm willing to gamble, and I think that a lot of this fuss about the mammogram started because right after Mrs. Ford and Mrs. Rockefeller, some very enterprising moneymakers went out and bought x-ray equipment, put it on a van, and started going around college campuses and mammographing everything in sight, whether it's a zero mammograph or a normal mammograph, doesn't make any difference. They're both x-ray. And under 35, it is, you shouldn't. There's no need, unless you have a symptom. But over 35 to 40, if you're high risk, I would say once a year. And if you have a doctor that you respect a great deal, and he says no, he doesn't want to start doing it once a year until 40, then listen to them, because this is a gray area and there's no yes or no. I'm giving the consensus of people and that I've interviewed and stuff I've read, that if you are high risk, 35 is the time to start annual mammograms. But a lot of doctors feel 40 is enough, is early enough. On the other hand, I have heard people say that their doctors absolutely refuses to do mammograms at all on the ground that it gives them too much radiation. That's nonsense. There is leaky equipment. There are mm-hmm. no two ways about it. There are a lot of doctors that have equipment that goes back to World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaks. It gives you too much irradiation. It doesn't have the attachments that concentrate only on the breast, and it will irradiate other parts of you. You stay away from that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question you don't want bad equipment. That's why I recommend hospitals. This is not to say that a lot of private practitioners don't have excellent equipment. It's just that there's no way for me to go around and inspect everybody's equipment. I'm fairly certain that a busy hospital or clinic does.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can do is generalize. A lot of doctors may be furious with me, but every woman has to do her own inspection. There's no reason why she can't walk into a doctor's office and say, when did you have your equipment inspected?
There's absolutely no reason why. If more women would do it, we'd probably all be better off just from the example it gives.
Well, I have found that doctors really enjoy having somebody that asks intelligent questions.
Mm.
What they don't like is the kind of thing, well, I was constipated the day before yesterday, you know, that kind of thing. But if you walk in, the good doctors don't mind.
Yeah.
I think this is more in the patient's heads. The only thing is sometimes they don't know the answers, and they'll bluff their way through and pretend to be too busy or too this or too that, and the real problem is they don't know what to say.
Yeah, and that, if you suspect that,
it's time to leave that.
Time to leave, and we have about 5 minutes. Is there anything that you haven't covered that you would like to cover?
Well, I've touched on the role of male domination
mm-hmm.
As far as surgery is concerned. I think that I should also point out that real money was not put into the study of breast cancer until 1966, after the cause of lung cancer, which was at that time almost entirely a masculine disease,
mm-hmm.
was found. Even now, the cause of lung cancer has been found. There's millions of dollars being poured into keeping people from smoking in airlines, in certain parts of airplanes, and in restaurants, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. In 1966, somebody in Congress asked that a breast cancer task force be created at the National Cancer Institute, specifically to try to find the cause of breast cancer and a cure. And finally, in 1970, money started coming in, and then when the National Cancer Act was passed in Christmas, I think it was, 1971, the money has been coming in. It's still a drop in the bucket next to what's been put into lung cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, I think, worth noticing that the Congress has always been male-dominated. National Cancer Institute is male-dominated.
Right.
The whole breast cancer task force at the National Cancer Institute is male. The whole, I've got the data broken down for the American Cancer Society in the book, but it's just a fraction of women involved in policy-making decisions. I went to a breast cancer conference shortly after Mrs. Rockefeller here in the Waldorf Astoria, and the whole panel was male.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking along the lines of what I found out in the Soviet Union, which is, after all, a country that is very tightly run, to say the least,
sure.
and not known particularly for its sensitivity to women,
mm-hmm.
and does have nationalized medicine, so the fee-for-service business would not come in, wouldn't enter into the picture, that the surgery in Moscow is much more understanding than the surgery in Leningrad, even though all the women have no choice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just do whatever the doctor tells them. They're not given any choice. As a matter of fact, nobody's ever told they have cancer. in the Soviet Union. You don't talk about it. It was always mammary carcinoma, even with me. We didn't use the word cancer. Now, in Sweden, I interviewed a doctor, Dr. Helen Westerberg, a young, beautiful woman, and she said that Swedish women are very, very unhappy about losing breasts. And the chief of the breast cancer department is a Dr. Jerzy Einhorn, a man. And she suggested that they have some kind of a group therapy kind of thing to help the women go through this ordeal. And he laughed and he said, we don't need it. They're stalwart Swedish women. And Dr. Westerberg said, let's give it a try. And she said, and she repeated again and again, Dr. Einhorn was shocked when he found out how attached Swedish women are to their breasts. He was absolutely shocked, and he said it again and again and again. And she told me again and again.
Yeah.
He just didn't understand it. There is a certain amount of insensitivity that a man can't help but having. They can try, but they cannot understand it the way another woman can. That's all there is to it. And I've seen this in my interviewing. There are quite a few medical oncologists at the National Cancer Institute, and they are much more sensitive to these, I can't even call them psycho-emotional problems, because they're not really problems, but the feeling, that I have when I wear a low neck and I bend over and I sort of grab myself so that the prosthesis doesn't show. It's just a little thing, and it's not that important, so what if it showed?
Mm-hmm.
But I do it.
Mm-hmm.
If I go into a place that has a mass dressing room,
mm-hmm.
I find that, I sort of go through different motions not to be a spectacle.
Right.
But there are things that only a woman can understand and a man just can't. But in the money end, it's just too much to be a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
The money has really only been coming into breast cancer since 1970. It took 4 years to gear up. The appropriation was requested in 1966, and I think they got $500,000 or something. This year, I think the budget for breast cancer is $9 million. And the total war on cancer is supposed to be $1 billion with $10 million every year, mm-hmm. or $100 million every year, or something like that. But I must add, although it sounds like a lot of money, the Pentagon budget this year is $92.8 billion.
Billion. On that happy note, we are going to have to close the program. I want to thank you very much for being my
guest.
Glad
to be here.
The book is called Breast Cancer, A Personal History and an Investigative Report. It's written by Rose Kushner. I urge you to go out and buy it, even if it does cost $10, because I think it's worth every penny. It's published by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, and it's a useful book. I don't think any woman should be without it. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
I'm Viv Sutherland.